Hello, everyone, and welcome to a new episode of the Publisher Lab. My name is Terrence Timmons, and joined here today with me is a special guest, Connor Brick, my friend and colleague. He's a publisher success manager. And you want to introduce yourself?
Yeah, my name is Connor Brook. I'm a VIP publisher success manager. I'm very excited to be here today at the Publisher Lab and talking about some of the industry insights that Terrence and I are going to talk about today.
Yeah, well, great having you on the show today. We also have Manny helping out, as you guys are familiar. We're all appreciative, Manny. Today we have a great topic or list of topics for you, going over some AI news revolved around OpenAI and some of the further developments we've seen, but also some two interesting pieces about how the publishing world is going to change and the values we think is going to help our publishers today.
Yes, we do. And we do have a couple of stories here to start out. We're going to have AI news today on the docket, and we have some social media news. Starting off with OpenAI and journalism. So OpenAI released a blog this week where they were covering and responding to the whole lawsuit situation from the New York Times last week. OpenAI, which is known for their AI tools, is currently in the limelight due to the lawsuit from the New York Times. OpenAI's primary goal is to develop AI that empowers problem solving used by millions worldwide, including over 92% of the Fortune 500 companies that they serve. However, the lawsuit, which OpenAI sees as an opportunity to clarify its practices, focuses on the company's use of internet materials for training AI models, a process that OpenAI defends as fair use. And I think we brought up this topic last week with Tyler on the show, where we brought up the concept of if in school, teachers are allowed to use copyrighted material to educate their students for educational purposes, could we make the argument that OpenAI is using copyrighted materials for educational purposes, just not on students, right? It's on AI. And their significant point of contention is that the things that the New York Times had presented was regurgitating the information from their website. And they, OpenAI said that it was some sort of a regurgitation bug in their AI model, which they acknowledge and they're actively working to minimize. And surprisingly, the lawsuit came despite OpenAI's efforts towards the partnership with the New York Times, who, according to OpenAI, manipulated prompts to induce this bug. And that the action that the OpenAI model took isn't typical to regular users of what would happen. And despite these challenges, OpenAI remains committed to collaborating with news organizations aspiring to enhance journalism through AI technology. And we were talking a little bit before the show that a lot of this partnerships that they recently had were with Axel Springer SE as well as the Associated Press. What's your guys' take on OpenAI's response regarding this copyright situation?
Well, Terrence, I think the New York Times isn't too happy about losing traffic, are they?
No, I don't think they're happy at all.
Yeah, when you think about the New York Times as a very traditional news source media that, you know, at the end of the day, they're trying to protect their nest egg. And I was actually doing a little bit of research before this, and using SEMrush, I actually saw that the New York Times overall in the last year, in 2023, actually dropped in 50% organic search traffic. And definitely this is starting to raise the alarms, I'm sure, internally at the New York Times, especially when they're seeing more insurgence when it comes to AI, when it comes to copying content, especially from their own pages. Mm-hmm. So you can tell that, you know, they're trying to see whatever, do whatever they can to, you know, prevent this. And of course, this has led them to go to the courts.
Yeah. I think that's it. So I guess I want to sort of frame this just a little bit. So how I see this is there's three points. One is, of course, as you mentioned, the traffic drop and business impacts of the New York Times. Maybe, you know, this is part of why the business negotiations broke down in the first place, because, you know, from OpenAI's own post on this, they said, hey, we were working with New York Times. We're trying to get a deal going. We've got deals already done with Axel Springer. We got deals done with the Associated Press. But then something happened and this deal fell through. And then now we're met with this lawsuit. And then to your point, the regurgitation is just, it looks like you can prompt ChatGPT in a particular way to get a particular response. OpenAI says it's a rare bug. The New York Times says it's not. And then also another point that OpenAI says is they said everything's under fair use. They say if the content is on the internet, it's fair use to, for our training data. And as to many, what you were alluding to earlier, which is for educational purposes, right, a classroom can have, you know, any copyrighted content in there, and that's considered fair use under educational purposes because it's being used to teach. So I guess that sort of logically falls on to is a large language model, can it be used copyright content to learn? And then how do you classify that? So just with that framing, I kind of wanted to ask, you know, do you think we're getting to a point where we actually need to take the training of a large language model as like an individual person, or is it both, you know, still the business that's running it?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, I think, you know, what OpenAI is trying to say is that like they have, you know, the ability to basically take in all this content, but I think we need to put more of the power in the individual user, I think, when it comes to copying content. Because I mean, when it comes to the New York Times, they're probably the first of many companies that this is going to come, come forward with it too. So, you know, this is starting to set the precedent, like saying like, hey, like what's going to kind of happen kind of going forward when it comes to content creation, especially when it comes to the regurgitation of it too.
Yeah. What I find interesting about this is all of the leverage kind of seems to be in OpenAI's pocket, in the sense that their model's already trained, mm-hmm. right? You can't undo that. The traffic's already losing and the user behavior's already changing. Can't really undo that. So, you know, what is New York Times trying to gain out of this? Are they trying to regain traffic, regain users, get a huge settlement or a good deal out of OpenAI? So I think what's going to happen from this is the New York Times will get a settlement that has some sweet deal for using their content and getting some royalty out of that. That's how I sort of see this playing out, but I could be wrong. But the thing is, the New York Times is dependent on their users for traffic, and if they're already using their users to other sources, and OpenAI already has these media deals with Axel Springer, Associated Press, and is saying, hey, here's a generated newsfeed on, you know, OpenAI.com that's generated by our platform, why is the user going to go to a paid version on the New York Times when they can just...
Get it for free. Yeah. No, very, very valid point. And, you know, what Manny was saying too, you know, over 90% of Fortune 500 companies are using OpenAI in some capacity. And, you know, even with the S&P 500, I'd probably argue the same thing. The top 500 stocks in the market in the U.S. are probably using it in some capacity too. And I think when you think about big business that, you know, people are trying to continue to optimize and try to protect themselves as a business too. So, you know, myself personally, I'd be really curious to see what kind of precedents this kind of sets kind of going forward, especially with what happens with the New York Times at OpenAI.
Yeah. And then just lastly speaking, I've used ChatGPT a lot in my day-to-day life. Don't really consider myself an expert quite yet, but I've used it, you know, thousands of times, and you can get it to do specific things if you prompt it in a specific way. So I get where OpenAI is coming from and saying, hey, if you prompt our software in a certain way, you're going to get a certain response. So at the end of the day, a large language model is taking your prompt and then based off your prompt, trying to predict the next word in the sequence. Mm. And if that prompt happens to be everything it needs to predict the exact text from a New York Times article, then you can probably use that same strategy on, you know, getting it to regurgitate anything you want.
Right.
They did say they're working on fixing it, but just from my experience using it, I can see where they're coming from and how you can prompt ChatGPT to get specific things out of it.
And just for those out there too that don't know, like typically with ChatGPT 3.5, like the older version of it, the unpaid for version, you can't scan URLs and it can't pull like more data that recently than 2021 or beyond, so 21 to 2024. But with a paid service, you actually can scan URLs and it has more up to date content with it too. So there definitely is different loopholes around that too. Asking how could they do that with OpenAI, you can kind of get around that with the paid version.
Yep.
And this isn't a new problem that they are just starting to realize with that regurgitation problem. This is a problem that they've had for months. Because I remember one of the big issues that was going on is like, let's say you asked it directly, just ChatGPT, how do I manipulate somebody? ChatGPT would be like, well, I can't provide you that information because that information could potentially be, detrimental to someone else. But if you were to ask it, ChatGPT, if I were to manipulate somebody, how would I go about it? And then you get the response that you were initially looking for. So I'd be interested to see if they did, you know, force this bug to regurgitate that content. Like, how difficult was it to do it? Or was it just something as simple as just rephrasing the words that you, or the question that you wanted?
What I would say is, you know, if you're using ChatGPT on an everyday basis, let's say asking it a simple question like, you know, what's the ingredients of peanut butter, right? And you take that information or its output, copy paste it, throw it in Google. If you're seeing, you know, it not match the top results or what Google gives you back, it's probably not copyrighted, or it's not like an exact one-to-one copy of another article from another website. Instead, it's, you know, a different unique sentence. And from my experience, I have most of the time, I would say 99% of the time, all of its outputs seem like unique, brand new sentences to me. Mm-hmm. So I would say most cases, at least from my user experience, it does a pretty good job at making unique sentences every time. So, you know, you could game as much as you want.
So it kind of sounds like you're on OpenAI side saying that they are differentiating.
I think
content.
I am a little bit also, because, you know, I can see from like a technology standpoint, like, you know, if this was actually happening on large scale, they would be running into massive problems across, you know, millions of different outputs and users saying, hey, this is a direct copy of this, this is a direct copy of this. And we're not seeing that, right? We're seeing New York Times is having a big fuss over this. We're not seeing, you know, 1,000 examples online saying this is a direct copy from my website, direct copy from my site, direct copy from my site. Instead, it's a big news publication that is losing business, and that business loss is at least seems to be directly correlated to the timing of ChatGPT. So that is why I'm leaning more on the side of this being a rare bug rather than this being the common output of ChatGPT.
Well, going from one concern for OpenAI to another one.
Oh, man, there you go today.
Yeah, so let's jump into something that they're kind of trying to curb and circumvent before this upcoming 2024 U.S. election. And with a few policy changes that they've had where you can and can't do now. So leading up to the 2024 election, OpenAI has taken a significant step to curb the misuse of their artificial intelligence tool. This move is primarily aimed at preventing the spread of AI-generated misinformation, which could potentially influence voters. OpenAI, known for its powerful ChatGPT and DALL-E tools, is imposing a ban on using these technologies for political campaigning, lobbying, and any activities that might discourage voting, such as creating chatbots that impersonate candidates or local governments. To enhance transparency, OpenAI plans to embed details about the origins of the images created by DALL-E and ensure that ChatGPT's outputs, especially when linked to news reporting, are accompanied by appropriate links and attributions. Additionally, in another policy update that OpenAI did, and that first article was from the Wall Street Journal, and this next one is from Mashable, where OpenAI's policies got a quiet update removing a ban on military and warfare applications. It recently revised its policy in a way that was significantly impact its stance on the military's and warfare uses. This update, which was effective on January 10th, has dropped the previous restrictions against employing its AI tools in military and warfare contexts. And the policy now specifically forbids only the development and use of weapons with AI technology. This change has sparked a conversation about the possible implications of AI in military applications. There's a growing interest, especially from the United States Department of Defense, in exploring the responsible use of AI administrative and intelligence operations. AI's role in the military sphere isn't new, but it's already being used in areas like decision support systems, autonomous vehicles, and intelligence and targeting systems. So do you think that these updates to their policies is something that they're just trying to get ahead of leading, you know, as AI continues to further develop? Do you think that this is just kind of like their lawyers talking to be like, we got to put these policies in place beforehand, otherwise it's going to become a real big problem and we're going to be the focal point of the issues here.
Yeah, well, we're definitely really getting in the meat and potatoes. We go from, you know, content duplication into voter suppression and, you know, talking about war and politics with ChatGPT. So it gets a little deeper into that. But
welcome to the Publisher Lab, Connor. Welcome to the Publisher Lab.
Yeah, thank you, Manny. What do you think about it, Terrence? I'll go second.
Yeah, we're really touching on a lot of different aspects of, I guess, how large language models are being used in our world, right? So for the first one, right? Ban on, you know, AI tools for political campaigns and using, like, voter suppression. So this makes sense, I guess, first of all, from a PR standpoint, is my first thought. And my brain immediately goes to that Netflix documentary, The Social Dilemma, where Facebook had this huge scandal with how their online ad platform was used to target swing voters in states to, you know, vote for one candidate over the other in the last presidential election we had. So that's why my first thought is OpenAI is trying to cover their backs a little bit when it comes to the use of political ads. A couple points I want to say is, like, you know, the things they outlined on how they're preventing it doesn't really sound that robust to me. As someone that has, you know, played with AI tools, you know, and seen how like images are created, a lot of these can get a good round, right? It's, it'll encode details about the, you know, provenance of images that are generated. Well, someone can just bypass that by scraping all the metadata or taking a screenshot on top of the generated image that has no metadata associated with it. So there's ways to get around that, right? So this doesn't seem like they're putting a stop to anything. Rather, it's saying, hey, it's against our policy. Don't do it. This is our feeble attempt at trying to stop it, but if something bad happens, it's not on us. Those are just bad actors using our software.
Yeah, it seems like they're really trying to cover their bases, making sure that, like, hey, if anything were to come back, that they don't want the fingers kind of pointed at them, and rightfully so, too. I mean, anything when it comes to voter suppression and, you know, tampering of things, especially when it comes to government, I mean, I don't think any company wants to be part of that whatsoever. Yeah. And even kind of dipping a little bit more into the removing the ban on military warfare applications, just to kind of give the audience, like, a little bit understanding of how robust when it comes for, like, AI and when it comes to warfare. Actually, in the article goes in a little bit more detail about it, but the Israeli forces are actually using an AI tool called the Gospel. And what the Gospel actually does is that it basically targets, you know, potential people that they need to, you know, get rid of in the war efforts, but it actually makes sure to not hit anyone that are innocent bystanders that should not be targeted too. So just showing, like, on a large scale, like, what AI is trying to do, like, they're trying to make sure that they give a tool to the, you know, the public of saying, like, hey, we want to make sure we help you, but they also want to be really intentional. And what we're seeing is, like, whether it be a war effort and also voter suppression, that they're trying to make sure that they kind of give that resource available, but they don't want to give too much where they can kind of be saying, like, have the finger kind of pointed at them. Yeah. At least it's kind of my take.
Yeah, no, I agree with your take 100%. And also, they're playing this game of trying to balance their AI model by putting on some guardrails, but not too many. So it makes, you know, the responses all be as policy. ChatGPT can't say this, right? They want it to still give an answer to questions that are, you know, more benign in nature. So, like, you know, an example on the military applications, right? You won't be able to ask it how to make a bomb, but you'll probably be able to ask it what's the biggest bomb ever made, or which country owns, you know, the biggest nuclear arsenal, for example, right? That's more like historical information, or, you know, just factual stuff rather than uses and actual, you know, what's the term they used? Use and development of weapons, right? So they're pushing away from that and saying, okay, the other stuff is fine, but we're still having these policies in place in case it goes wrong to cover their backs a little bit. It's one of those areas that I think it's like they can't have too many guardrails, but they need to have some in place for the extreme examples.
100%.
Yeah.
I think this kind of mirrors a discussion that Terrence, you and I had on a show a few months ago where Facebook was making it a requirement that if someone uses AI for political campaign reasons, and I think we talked about this like last November, December, that they would be required to include some sort of like transparency information regarding what model was used for AI, for that AI creation of that ad or whatever it may be, just for the same thing, to try to like get in front of any issues that the company might have, you know, leading up to November 2024.
Yep.
And then moving on, because we're starting to see that a lot of customers are starting to diversify with AI. This story is coming from the Wall Street Journal as well, where many companies that were once reliant on OpenAI's technology are now seeking to diversify their AI sources. This trend tended to follow the management upheaval that happened with OpenAI in November, where we saw Sam Altman leave, mm-hmm. and then Microsoft hire him, and then the board being essentially removed, and then they brought back Sam Altman. Companies such as Walmart are advising their tech teams to explore various AI models, not just those from OpenAI, and to integrate internally developed platforms. That this diversification drive is being accelerated by competitors of OpenAI, who are capitalizing on the opportunity to attract customers seeking stability and a variety of AI solutions. Amazon Web Services has been particularly vocal about offering access to a range of AI models, including those from OpenAI's rivals. This message was emphasized by their annual convention, underscoring the importance of the choice in AI market. Now, the question for you guys is, aside from ChatGPT, are you guys using any other AI models in your day-to-day usage? Do you think that in the last few months, with all the turmoil that's been going on with OpenAI, do you see yourself switching to something like Copilot or even Google's Bard or any of the other OpenAI or any of the other AI models?
I think it's really important to have like a really diverse understanding, especially since like they're, you know, OpenAI was like the very like really first one to market, and it's something that we're all extremely familiar with too. And I think especially, I don't want to speak for Terrence, but you know, I think that we both would probably want to have a decent understanding of both, because I'm sure that they're going to have their pros and cons. And I think, you know, it's like really really important for us to understand like how we can both like leverage these in the space and really have a full understanding of both.
Yeah, I agree with your point that they were first to market. And it was sort of, you know, the first usable product that worked on scale. So everyone just was like, jump on ChatGPT. It's easy to use, easy to sign up, no technical setup. But like, I think it's going to start to change a little bit. And my reasoning is like, for example, I don't use ChatGPT for images. Honestly, I don't think that DALL-E is that good compared to the other ones out there. As we talked earlier on the show, like Midjourney is fantastic at image generation. And if I'm going to generate images, I would prefer to use Midjourney or a different software. So in that regards, I am not using OpenAI already because someone else is delivering a better product. Now, an interesting statistic I guess I heard was, if you look at the development of, you know, how good ChatGPT is now, or let's say how good Open, like the best open source software is today, it's as good as ChatGPT was 8 months ago. Now, if there's that much of a gap between the best open source version, which anyone in the world can access and see the back end code and anything, if ChatGPT is only ahead by that much, you know, they'll maintain their lead, but not by a lot. So I think they'll still keep their market dominance in that case by having the best model. And once these third-party models start to have better UIs and better application for people to use, more and more people will use it, right? Yeah. There's still a bit of a technical hurdle, I think, with some of these other models. For example, like you still have to have a developer background to set one up and get one running on your personal machine. You still have to have a developer background to feed in, to figure out a data source to feed it in to fine-tune it. But once those restraints start going away, and it becomes easier for the regular person to use, then I'll see that a diversification happen a lot more faster. And then to the point in this article where Walmart was saying, hey, developers, use other, you know, AI or large language models that aren't OpenAI, you know, that are maybe more cost effective, easier to train, can be more specific for a particular task that we need done. I see that happening a lot more with companies. Especially as everyone's trying to shift towards a profitability focus with how the economy is. So I do see a diversification starting to will happen, in my opinion. That's what I predict. I don't know about you. Do you use other models in your day-to-day?
Not too much in my day-to-day. I think I'm just so well integrated when it comes to OpenAI and ChatGPT. And
yeah,
I'll be honest, like I kind of follow like where the money does before I kind of get a full invest into like another product or tool. I mean, OpenAI in itself is a juggernaut. I mean, it's an $80 billion company.
Yeah.
So I'm going to put, you know, spend my time and resources with a company that's already like really well established and having all these different tools and resources, engineers like you're alluding to as well. But I mean, I would be reminiscent to say if I'm not going to go to like a competitor like Google and kind of see like what they offer and see like what the different things, because they're going to want to differentiate their product. And it's interesting, which we'll probably talk a little bit more about later, but even OpenAI is encouraging other users to go explore other options too, to kind of take this burden off them too. So it'll be kind of interesting to see how things kind of develop.
I have a question. So I'm assuming you're an iPhone user, right?
I am an iPhone user, yes.
So you probably had your iPhone for multiple generations or generations of the phone. So iPhone, you know, 15, you know, 14 all the way down.
I only have a 12 Pro. I'm not that cool.
Okay.
You
bought
an iPhone 15 though, don't you?
I have a 14 right now.
I see.
So okay. Anyways, I've been using Apple for, let's say, 7 odd years. Is that like the same amount of time you probably use an Apple phone?
Yeah, I'd say it's pretty rare. I mean, sorry, pretty spot on.
Pretty spot on. So now, with your current phone situation, do you see yourself switching phone providers anytime soon?
I think it'd be very difficult for me to switch.
Very difficult. Phone providers. Okay. And now my question is, how come? And then you'll see where I'm going. I'm going to apply that same to your AI usage.
You know, I'm going to follow along here. I think I know where you're going, but for the audience, I'm going to keep them playing along. But, okay. you know, my life is very much integrated to everything when it comes to Apple, when it comes to my life, when it comes to, like, let's say I take a picture, it's already part of my cloud storage when it comes to photos. When I want to have I have a once a month FaceTime with my family, with my mother, my dad, I use, you know, FaceTime messaging. So, you know, that's just a couple of examples, but everything's very well integrated into my day-to-day life on my iPhone.
So it will take a huge value add with another like phone to get you to switch over.
It'd need to take something pretty monumental for me to switch.
Pretty monumental. And Apple has a lot of retention methods, as you mentioned, cloud storage, you know, habits and other services that are like keeping you locked in. So my question is, if you look at your current AI usage with ChatGPT, do you see yourself switching if your needs are met, let's say, in one model has, let's say it's 3.5 ChatGPT, but it's free to use.
Mm-hmm.
Would you switch to a third party in that case?
I think it would need to be pretty compelling for me to actually switch on a day-to-day for, like, just when it comes to, like, general tasks that I need help with or doing basic coding for my everyday life. But, you know, like I said, it would take something pretty compelling for me to do a complete switch over and not use it whatsoever.
Gotcha. So I guess, like, I'm in that same boat as you, Connor. It would take something pretty compelling because the value I get out of ChatGPT is still so immense. Like when it comes to text generation, code generation, the data analysis feature.
Prompts,
right? There's still a lot of value I get from it. So I still think it would take a lot for me to move. And I'm still okay willing paying $20 a month to use ChatGPT. So even for a free version to come out, it's going to have to be at ChatGPT 4.0 or better, in my opinion, for me to switch.
Yeah, I think that's pretty fair.
Pretty fair. So I guess then that means no one's going to really switch until the third-party models get really good.
Yeah, so there's going to be OpenAI is going to bear a lot of weight just because there's going to be a lot of people like yourself and I that probably feel the same way.
Yeah, it's not good enough or it's too much of a technical setup to get it running.
Yep.
Fascinating.
Does the same apply if we're looking at the same question from a business perspective? Like not from an individual use case, but like from a business?
I would say yes. However, business cases can be a little bit different in the terms that, like, let's say, so a large language model is really good at generating text, right? Now, what if you could feed a large language model on, let's say, text on your company specifically and have it do a specific task within your company? Let's say, for example, a lot of companies use Slack as their communications platform. So what if you decided to make like a Slack answering bot that would just auto answer questions in Slack channels that would be based off of all of your company's knowledge? Now, for that, I might not trust ChatGPT with my data. So maybe I would want like a closed model that I can train myself, you know, for privacy concerns. Or maybe I want to get something super specific. Maybe I only ask it questions about, you know, HR related things, right? And train it just for HR questions, right? Then I would prefer to train my own model rather than fine tune an OpenAI one. And if it's cheaper to do that, then yeah, I'll go do that as a business. So it comes down to cost, I think, Manny, these.
Because I think that's the route that Walmart is trying to take right now. They're like, hey, let's try to keep all of our data centralized just within the company, use our models. So we'll see. We'll see how if big companies will continue to use OpenAI. I know I will. So like you guys, something big has to happen for me to switch over. And, you know, this is something that we've been talking about for months. I've tried Copilot. I've tried Bard. Last time Tyler asked me these questions, I hadn't. But even still, I'm not ready to make that switch.
Yeah, I've tried Bard the last time, too, and I didn't like its answer, so I immediately closed it out.
It also took forever to respond. It takes so much time thinking, and I'm like, dude, we got to. ChatGPT would have given me several answers
by now. There's your sample size, 3 for 3. It's going to be tough for us.
Yeah, and I bet if you ask, if you're at a company watching this, ask some of your colleagues, and I'm sure you'll get a similar answer. It just comes down to how much value is getting extracted from it, and then also the cost of it.
Great question for the publisher. So if you guys are using an AI model that's not OpenAI or ChatGPT, let us know in the comments. I'd love to know which ones you guys are using and why you guys are using them. But moving on to some social media news, going from the concept of keeping everything centralized like Walmart to having everything being decentralized for social media, Threads is actively working towards integrating with the Fediverse, notably including Mastodon, a popular decentralized social media platform. This initiative began with testing in December and aims to fully enable users to follow Mastodon accounts through Threads by the end of this year. The integration marks a significant step in the digital landscape, representing a shift towards more open, decentralized web. Notably, Meta CEO Mark Zuckerberg has expressed a vision for Threads to be totally open, aligning with broader industry trend. This move will allow for greater interaction and connectivity between users of Thread and Mastodon, embodying the future of web interactions as envisioned by leading tech executives. So the concept behind this is if you go on Twitter, you're only talking to Twitter users. You go on Reddit, you're only talking to Reddit users. In this case, if you go on Threads, you can now talk to users on other social media apps. Which is also kind of this concept that was written about by the Rolling Stone. Now, granted that this is an opinionated culture commentary piece, but users worldwide are frustrated with the limitations and surveillance of dominant search engines and social media platforms and are pioneering a move towards a new varied online experiences. This shift is marked by the rise of smaller, more intimate online communities and platforms driven by individual creativity and connection. As major social media players like Twitter decline, we're seeing a resurgence of human-run, personal-scale web spaces. This isn't just a change in technology, but a cultural shift towards a more democratized and open internet, fueled by a desire for more authentic, locally sourced digital experience. It's an exciting time and suggesting a future where the internet is shaped by diverse human scale alternatives to versus a dominant platform of today. Mm-hmm. So something where the concept of people are getting sick of large social media platforms. You hear it all the time with Gen Z, where they don't want to go onto Facebook, or even Instagram is something that the older generations are using. What's your guys' take, especially from a publisher perspective, of this concept of a lot of these sources are going to be more community based, where a lot of these publishers already might have a community in place and are in a better position than maybe someone like a giant social media company like Twitter to engage with their audiences.
Yeah, I think the word of 2024, kind of going onwards, especially in this space, would be decentralization. And I even take of the recent change when it came to Bitcoin now being part of an ETF now. So now you have different 401ks and different investments where you can actually put into Bitcoin, which is pretty monumental when you think about Bitcoin as a whole being a decentralized form of currency. And I think that's no different than what we're seeing here with Mastodon too, because at the end of the day, that basically users want to have decentralization instead of going to a place like Twitter where you have someone kind of controlling the end and, you know, only talking to Twitter versus having to talk to basically different spaces all at once with no one center being able to control it. And basically what that comes to into the publishing space for anyone out there too is that your audience is going to become even more valuable than it, how it already is too. So thinking about different ways how you can engage your community is going to become more and more prevalent, where depending on how you want to engage them, whether it be, I don't know, thinking like different ways you can do like outreach, newsletters, and like really engage that community and keep on doing, get them engaged with your content. I think it's going to make you put, you know, like a really powerful place, especially as you kind of like look forward in 2024.
Yeah. I agree with everything you mentioned. One initial idea from seeing this is, one, people are still going to be on the Threads domain when they're interacting with those Mastodon users, messaging, commenting, liking, etc. So this does seem to me like initially as a win for Threads in that case. Also, this, you know, if Mark Zuckerberg is saying, hey, let's go for the decentralized route, but at the same token, he is saying, hey, we're getting more distribution for Threads by bringing in a whole another platform as Mastodon.
It's a little conflicting.
It is a little conflicting. Yeah. However, on the whole point of decentralization, I agree 100%. And, you know, I see it as if you're a publisher, right? Let's say, for example, you just use Google search, right? Well, Google search is 80 billion monthly visitors, right? Biggest search engine in the world, biggest distribution channel in the world. You 100% want to be there, right? Now, let's take another example. Let's take YouTube.com, 70 billion monthly visitors, right? So if you are optimized for Google search, you're open to that pool. Now, if you're optimized to YouTube and have YouTube channel and videos, etc., now you're open to that pool too. So now your distribution goes from 80 million to 87 million. Now let's take another platform, Instagram, add that distribution to that. Now what you're seeing is your distribution pool is just growing and growing and growing. So as a publisher, what you want to do is be on as many platforms as possible, right? Have a website for Google search, have a YouTube channel for YouTube content, be on Instagram for an Instagram post, be on Twitter or now X for that traffic, be on Facebook for that traffic, be on Threads for that traffic, be on Mastodon for that traffic. But as you can see, they're just getting a ton of these platforms. And if the more platforms they get, the more split up it's becoming, and it's becoming more work for a publisher. So I think what this is kind of showing, this decentralized like approach, is actually presenting a problem, which is, you know, if I'm a user, do I want to have Instagram installed on my phone? Do I want to have Snapchat installed on my phone? Do I have Twitter installed on my phone, right? Well, I'm going to install whatever app my friends are on, right? But if I can install maybe an app or have a service that I can access all the different ones at once, then it doesn't matter which one my friends are on, because that one will be what my friends are on if they're on Instagram, you know, et cetera. So I think this actually showcases a big problem that we'll be looking to solve, hopefully, in 2024. But from a publisher standpoint, what this tells me is, you know, as you mentioned, really connect and engage with your audience and figure out ways to retain your audience, you know. But that also means you're going to have to do work on all these platforms in order to retain them and have that presence. So that's sort of my take on this whole thing. And I see this as a step in the right direction.
Yeah, and I think that's pretty fair too. I guess I didn't really think of it like that way too, like when it does put a lot more work on publishers' plates, but I think in the grand scheme of things too, I think they're going to see like a really big net benefit of having this increased engagement than how it is like currently in the industry standard.
Yeah, 100%. And also, like, think about how cool it is, right? If you're on Threads and you have a decent following, then now all Mastodon users can see your stuff. You just increased your likes, your revenue by a good portion without doing any work, right? Yep. So I think that's a great thing that Threads is doing some of that work for publishers by doing the integration. But it's going to take these companies to work with other companies and negotiate deals that are beneficial for this to start connecting, you know, not just Threads and Mastodon, but could we get Threads connected with X, right?
Yep.
You know, and combine those two pools of distribution. So I'm not sure if that will happen yet, but I'm hoping we can get to that point because it would make a lot of people's lives easier, I imagine.
Absolutely.
Just having like one centralized social media, that would be the dream.
Yeah, it would be the dream, right? somewhere where all your friends are on, right? You don't have to think like, oh, you know, this friend is on Instagram, but they're not on Snapchat, right? Mm-hmm. Right. Everyone deals with that problem. So you end up being on Snapchat for some friends, but then you're on Instagram for other friends. And then you're on Facebook with like your relatives and grandparents, right?
And that's how you end up being on social media for 4 to 5 hours a day.
Yeah, exactly. And then we have this huge problem of short-term attention span and, you know, all the problems.
All these instant gratifications all the time.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Next thing you know, they're going to have like a little like icon next to their name or their username saying like, oh, this came from Facebook or this came from Twitter.
Yeah.
And then it's going to be like, oh, it's a Twitter user.
Oh, it's a Reddit user.
Oh, it's another one of those Reddit users.
Yeah. I mean, think about Reddit, though, in the sense like they had the right idea by having like all these subreddits and separate communities, which I think is the right idea. But it's just, it's still centralized on the Reddit.com platform. Like, if I'm a publisher, right? Let's say I'm a publisher and I have, like, the best blog about cats, right? And it is the most popular. Users love me. They, you know, they like interacting with each other. Then I think that publisher has a huge opportunity to take their audience and put it in somewhere. I don't know where that somewhere is yet. And basically have a place where they control the whole distribution of content. Maybe that somewhere is a place where their audience can post, you know, on all the different platforms, but it still is one, you know, central area.
Yeah.
You know, I've heard Discord has like some communities going on in that route too. But as a publisher, I just think there's a lot of opportunity for pulling in your community and really retaining it. And I think that will be the best way for a publisher to get through this huge AI wave that's coming.
That's a great way to cast like the widest net possible if everyone's in just one spot.
Exactly.
Awesome. Well, fellas, that's the story docket that we got for this week. I just want to say thank you both of you for joining me this week. Glad to have you back, Terrence. Glad to have you on, Connor. Terrence, if you want to send us out or if you guys have anything else that you guys want to include.
Do you have any... socials or plugs you want to give yourself, Connor?
No socials, no plugs. Definitely love being part of the show and looking forward to being back here again sometime.
Awesome. Well, thanks again for everything you do, Manny. We appreciate you. Thanks for hopping on, Connor. It was a great show. And thank you to the viewers for hopping on. We hope you enjoy this episode of The Publisher Lab. Please check us out on Spotify, Apple, YouTube. And if you have any thoughts about the show, please leave them in the comments below, and we will see you all next time.